the battle over preserving Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy.
They've whittled King's narrative down to this narrative of love. Now, love is crucial in King's thinking, but King never ever decoupled love from power or justice.
The Reverend was killed 50 years ago today, and since then, people on all sides have tried to claim his story for their own gain. Plus, actor Michael K. Williams branches out.
The ray of hope that I can make a difference. Not as an entertainer, this documentary made me feel good because it let me know I can make a difference with what I have as just being a man from the community.
And how the U.S. has purposely pushed immigrants crossing the border into dangerous territory.
Because of us, fences were built. Because the fences were built, maybe 10,000 people have died in the desert.
This is The Takeaway for April 4th, 2018.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street.
That was it. I said, Dr. King, just as he straightened up, I said, Dr. King, and the bullet exploded in his face.
I was very shocked when I heard the news that Martin Luther King had been wounded, and then when he died.
It's going to make it bad for the racial problems all over the United States now.
And it makes me wonder just what kind of a world we are living in and what's going to happen now.
Martin Luther King tried to help the Negroes and the white from not having a violence or any kind of eruptions. I think that they shouldn't assassinate him.
I pray that his family can find comfort in the memory of all he tried to do for the land he loved so well.
We were always willing to share Martin Luther King with the world because he was a symbol of the finest man is capable of being. Yet to us, he was a father and a husband.
Today, we mark 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King was in Memphis to support the city's striking sanitation workers. They were protesting abusive working conditions and low wages. The night before he was killed, King spoke at the Mason Temple in Memphis, delivering what would become known as the Mountaintop Speech.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
In a sense, Dr. King foreshadowed what was to come. The following night, April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. Today, the Lorraine Motel stands as it did back in 1968. It's no longer a functioning motel. It's part of the National Civil Rights Museum. Dr. King, well, he's grown larger than life. He's an icon of the civil rights movement and a symbol for many. But for Charles McKinney, who's an associate professor of history at Rhodes College in Memphis, there's a danger in the way King's image is enshrined into our national consciousness. Professor McKinney warns us that danger should not be ignored.
We've worked hard to produce a version of King that is like a black Santa Claus, right? To decenter King, to move him away from the political ideologue, to move him away from the person who was comfortable with mass-based protest. And that's a problem because that's not the real King, right? That's not the historical King, the King who came to Memphis in defense of sanitation workers who were fighting for their lives, engaged in this radical affirmation of their own humanity, fighting for a living wage. The king who wanted to restructure the fabric of American life. The king who believed that the three evils of American society, racism, militarism, and poverty, needed to be confronted, primarily and chiefly be confronted by the federal government, right? So we're celebrating this cotton candy version of King, right? That says...
That's a loaded word, a cotton candy version of King.
Right. I mean, you know, January 15th, it's a day of service right now. So I don't, you know, and all due respect to people who go out and do service work, but, you know, if Martin King were alive now, you know, he wouldn't be telling the nation that they need to go paint houses, right? He wouldn't be telling the nation that they need to go engage in this one day of service. This was somebody who was directly and intimately involved in trying to put together a mass-based movement to restructure American society. He was in the process of putting together the Poor People's Campaign to bring tens of thousands of poor people of all colors from all across the country to Washington, D.C. to confront the reality of poverty in American life, right? So we've got to look really hard to go to find the places and spaces where that king is celebrated, as opposed to the sort of toothless candy cotton version of King that we've grown up with now in the wake of, particularly in the wake of the King holiday.
When we talk about King as a political tool, how is he being used as a political tool? I know you're telling me that we are celebrating this, and it's a difficult phrase for me to say because of how loaded it is, but this cotton candy version of King, if we are celebrating that, then there must be a puppet master using this in some way. What is the form that this political tool is taking?
This is a bipartisan effort, right? And an ecumenical effort, right? This is an effort from a political establishment, a corporate establishment, right? This is an effort, this is a multifaceted effort to move us away from the king who would stand in opposition to so much of what's going on in American life. So for instance, when politicians extol the virtues of King, they extol the virtues of a man who fought for particular political positions, who fought for the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so for people who think that politics is the end-all and be-all of a civil rights movement, right? And these are folks, again, across the political spectrum. When you push that narrative, then to a large extent, you can say, hey, we won. Right? We got the legislation passed. Therefore, you know, game over. Now it's up to you folks to, you know, to go out and make real the promise of American democracy. When we have corporations, so for instance, during the Super Bowl, King's voice is used to sell Dodge Ram trucks, right? In the drum major speech. Two paragraphs later in that speech, King calls out the auto industry for making big, ridiculous cars that people who can't afford to buy them in the first place spend money on. That's literally, you know, 17 lines down from the line that gets quoted in the Dodge Ram ad. So, you know, so King as corporate shill, this is a whole scale effort by forces in American life, forces in American society, right? You know, Black History Month, Fortune 500 companies celebrating the life and legacy of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was fighting for a living wage. Do you pay your employees a living wage? Right? All the folks who are running around, who spend money every year to celebrate the life and legacy of Martin Luther King. The life and legacy of King was like, look, let's pay people a wage so they don't starve. Let's pay people wages so they don't qualify for welfare while they're working 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week or 60 hours a week, like the sanitation workers in Memphis. You know, so that's the life and legacy of King. King's legacy has been boiled down to sort of like, you know, it's the Barney purple dinosaur version of King. I love you, you love me. King was about love. No, that doesn't. Violence to King's legacy, right?
So you say it does violence to King's legacy, but is there any way that someone could cogently interpret it differently? Could this mean that all Americans, even white Americans, may see themselves in the face and experience of this black man? Is that one way to interpret it or not?
Well, that's one way to interpret it, right? But I think the way in which the dominant culture, the way in which, you know, popular culture now and our political culture has interpreted King is they've whittled King's narrative down to this narrative of love, right? Now, love is crucial in King's thinking, morally, politically, philosophically. But King never, ever, ever decoupled love from power or justice. King is saying, look, if love is truly guiding our efforts, then there's no way that there should be starvation in the richest country in the world. If love is guiding our efforts, then people who are in power, right, should be standing in the name of love, should be standing and working to explicitly correct all of the ills and all of the evils we see playing out on a daily basis in our society. So we've stripped away King's relationship with power and justice, and now we just talk about King and love, right? We talk about content of character and not the color of skin, right? Folks love to quote the second half of the dream speech. But no one wants to talk about the first half of the dream speech where he says, look, you know what? Based on my reading of power, love, and justice, we're going to be out in the streets and we're not going home until we see some justice, until we see power working on behalf of the disinherited in this society.
If you could tell us, based on all of your research, why you believe that King was assassinated, was it just because of love or were there deeper issues at play?
I tell my students frequently that I think one of the minor miracles of the civil rights movement was the fact that Martin Luther King actually lived to see 1968. We have to remember that this was a man who was marked for death from his very first campaign in Montgomery, Alabama, to the moment he is murdered in my city, in Memphis, on April 4th of 1968. Right? So we can't decouple his assassination from a 13-year-long effort to have him murdered. Racial terrorists plant a bomb under his home in Montgomery, Alabama. They didn't pull him off the side of the road. They didn't plant the bomb at his church office, right? Racial terrorists in 1955 tried to murder Martin Luther King, his wife Coretta, and their two young children, right? He's 26 years old. So he's going to spend the next 13 years living in the shadow of death. That, for me, is the point here. In terms of thinking about the assassination, we have to think about, I tend to think about the assassination as the tragic culmination of multiple efforts to see King dead, which then leads us back to having to confront the reality of violence, right? Particularly racial violence in American society. This is the most powerful advocate of nonviolence in the country, on the planet at this point. He is the face of nonviolence, not just nationally, but globally. And yet there are elements in our society that wanted to see him dead. Why? Because he's beginning to slowly understand that in order for us to move forward on these issues of poverty and racism and materialism and militarism, that it's time to start building a broad mass-based coalition, right? A coalition of poor folk, people from all backgrounds, from all races, from all walks of life.
Do you think it was that coalition of poor folks that ultimately marked him for death, that took him down in Memphis?
I think you can make that argument. Yes, most definitely.
When we talk about Memphis, some people say that in many ways there is a symbolism to him dying in Memphis. He was there hoping to raise wages for these garbage workers. And even to this day, Memphis has an unusually high poverty rate for a city of its size. How has Memphis been marked by MLK's assassination there?
We've worn this since April 5th, 1968, right? Now, I've only been in Memphis for 13 years, but in that amount of time, I've grown to love this city like no other. Memphis is such an amazing and wonderful and beautiful and complicated city, just like the people in it. We grapple with this. We deal with this. And one of the downsides of King being killed in our city, right, is that it obscures this long and beautiful struggle of activism, right, engaged in by black folk from the dawn of emancipation down to now, right? And so one of the things that I think we lose when we solely focus on the fact that King is killed here is we lose sight of the fact of his presence, of why he was here, right? We lose sight of the fact that he was called here by a group of men who had simply had enough. And this was not his first time in Memphis, right? He comes to Memphis in 1959 for a political rally. He comes to Memphis in 1966 to engage in the Meredith March, the March Against Fear, which is the last major civil rights march of the civil rights era. We wear this and it blots out the sun, right? It blocks so much other information, so many other things, right? And so this is a hard thing. And so the city has grappled with this for decades. But I think the way forward is to have an honest assessment, an honest accounting of the ways in which the city has changed and the ways in which it has not, black and white income. Black folks in this town still make 50% of what white folks make in this town.
Right? Hold on one second. So 50% of what white people make in Memphis is earned by people of African descent in that city today.
Yes, that number is virtually unchanged from 1968, right? We've got the highest black child poverty rate in the country. But also, have we made gains? Yes, we have made gains, right? So when we look over the course of the last 50 years, we see a dramatic expansion of the black middle class, but also we see poverty rates and African-American poverty rates virtually unchanged. Henry Louis Gates was once asked to talk about this period, this 50-year period, and he says, you know what? The easiest way to talk about this is to say it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Is there enough economic opportunity given the cloud of race within Memphis to allow someone to achieve your level of success today?
Memphis is going to have to be honest with itself, right, about what Memphis can do. So on the one hand, we say we want people to achieve, and we say we want to expand opportunities for African Americans. On the other hand, we tell companies and corporations that they should move to Memphis because they can pay their employees slave wages. Mm. The Chamber of Commerce used to have some language on their website before activists pointed it out that, you know, they talked about, hey, you know, move your company here. Hey, come to Memphis because, you know, we're not unionized and you can pay people really, really low wages.
If we could extrapolate for a minute and look at Memphis as sort of a hyper-focused example of something in America, what does it symbolize? Given all the controversy over apparent growing inequality in America right now, what does Memphis tell us and what should we be thinking about as we honor the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Memphis represents reality and potential. It represents the reality of persistent racial inequality. It represents the reality of what a town, what a city, what a county can look like when the majority of the people in that space, when African Americans are systematically and routinely shut out of the halls of power. It also represents potential. There are a growing number of organizations, a growing number of activist organizations, a growing number of mainline organizations, right? Shout out to Black Lives Matter, Memphis Grassroots Organizing Coalition, Coalition of Concerned Citizens, the Fight for 15, out in Memphis, right? Shout out to so many organizations in town who are doing the work of building, engaging in this beautiful struggle. There's a growing number of people working in the school system who are starting to understand, come to an understanding of the deleterious impact of segregation on education, right? We can't get around it. We simply can't, right? So there's a growing group of people who are saying, look, let's start having some real conversations about how we move forward, right? What's the definition of insanity? You keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Well, you know what? For the last 50 years, we've engaged in a series of practices and patterns that have gotten us here. We got to try something different. And so there's a critical mass of folks, I think, in this town, some elected officials, some other civic leaders, a few folks in the foundation arena, where we've got to get a few more of them on board, who are starting to say, hey, you know what, some of these old patterns and practices, they're not working. It's time to start thinking about new approaches. And so we see that in Memphis. We see the reality of inequality, but we also see so much potential to confront those realities.
Professor Charles McKinney, Associate Professor of History at Rhodes College. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest, Charles McKinney, said Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy has become distorted over time. And listeners, we are hearing from you. How is Dr. King's life addressed in schools today?
Hi, this is Steve, an elementary school music teacher from Nyack, New York. My students have the impression that Dr. King was a powerful speaker, close friend of the president, and widely accepted moral leader. I emphasize to them that he was arrested for protesting around 20 times, vilified by the press, and threatened with physical violence regularly. I also talk to them at length about the Poor People's Campaign, emphasizing the fact that much of what Dr. King hoped to achieve, particularly economic equality for all races, has still not yet been accomplished.
My name is Peggy, and I'm calling from Englewood, New Jersey, and I am actually a middle school art teacher. The decision about who does what to celebrate it is usually left up to me. And they might have a little bit of discussion, but unfortunately, it's not taken as seriously as I would like. I am a Black woman, and it is serious and important to me. So I do make a point of trying to incorporate some project around that time. However, it's just not enough devotion put to this. And it's sad because I teach in an urban school district and our kids really should learn more.
My name is Danielle and I'm calling from Hollywood, Florida. I have a son in fourth grade and they do learn a little bit about Martin Luther King and a little bit about Rosa Parks, but they don't really go deep into it. It's incumbent upon the parents to teach the children because the school is only going to touch the surface.
Hi, my name is Kristen. I'm calling from Evanston, and I wanted to talk about what my daughter's school does for Martin Luther King Day. They do an assembly, they have the kids perform, they read passages and sing songs, and it's like the most beautiful thing to see all the children up there, and I so appreciate District 65 for making it a priority.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page. Tweet us at The Takeaway or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
That was then First Lady Hillary Clinton at a campaign speech in 1996 for her husband, Bill Clinton's second term. She was making the case for criminal justice reform to support President Clinton's Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. That super predator idea? It stuck. Alleged gang members and young people of color were labeled dangerous, uncontrollable. It was the start of a cycle of juvenile punishment that continues today. This week, HBO's Vice is launching their sixth season with the episode Raised in the System. Actor Michael K. Williams hosts the episode. He also starred as Omar Little on the HBO series The Wire.
Trauma, whether it be physical, sexual, mental health, or just plain old good old-fashioned lack of resources in the home. You take a child that's coming from all of those realities. It's not about, oh, why did they make that dumb decision? If they're going to make it, it's about when do they make the dumb decision? It's a matter of time before they're going to do something stupid.
For Williams, those types of mistakes hit close to home. His nephew, Dominic DuPont, was sent to prison for second-degree murder and criminal possession of a weapon when he was only 19. Williams says he understands firsthand how easy it can be to be so young and caught up in the criminal justice system.
I was at risk. You know, I look at the mistakes and the bad choices I made in my life. It came from a lack of self-awareness and way too much access to nonsense.
Way too much access to nonsense.
Too much. You know, for me, it was to be blatant, it was, you know, drugs and partying. For my nephew Dominic, it was illegal firearms. So I look at, you know, what happened in my life, what happened in my nephew's life, and it's called adolescence. Dominic situation, long story short, young boys fighting over a girl. How many times have we heard that story? The difference is the amount of access that Dominic had to an illegal firearm made his repercussions to his bad choice a lot more severe than maybe in another neighborhood where it just would have been a fist fight and everybody would have went home with bumps and bruises.
So can you take us back to the beginning of that day that led you to your time in prison?
Yeah. So it was a hot summer day in June, early June. I had been back on break from college. Mm-hmm. I had a full-time job working as a security guard during the time of this incident. And we ran into a group of individuals who my brother had a prior altercation with over a girl. And that situation imploded immediately. It led to me retrieving a firearm, getting into an altercation. One bad decision, it could change your life for decades at a time.
Where was the gun at the time?
I had the gun in my residence. I lived in a very bad neighborhood. Essentially,
we lived in a very bad neighborhood.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Michael and I, you know.
Around the corner.
Right around the corner from me. And I learned very early on that if you were not the victor, in most instances, you would be the victim. I was concerned about, you know, things that might happen if we didn't have a firearm in the house. And, you know, it goes back to the point that Michael was making earlier. To have access to a firearm at that very young age, just turned 19 years old, and, you know, the situation essentially got out of control. Myself and the deceased, were struggling over this firearm. I take full responsibility because I bought an illegal firearm to this situation. Ultimately, struggle or not, I am the person who discharged that firearm, and I take full responsibility for that. What I will say is that, you know, I have to speak to my behavior, my conduct, and more importantly, how I have used prison as a platform for me to adjust issues and challenges that I had within myself that made me feel that it was necessary to bring a firearm into this situation, which led to the unfortunate death of someone.
It almost doesn't make sense because, you know, as grown men, we have a better understanding of complexity, nuance, and we forgive things. But when we're being punished as grown men for what we did as children, it messes with your mind. And you bring that out so expertly in this documentary. And so, Michael, I want to focus for a second on that conversation you had with Judge Denise Cubbin from Lucas County, Ohio.
The thought for years was that incarceration would rehabilitate people, but that's not the case. We were sending kids to the Department of Youth Services, that's kids' prison, by leaps and bounds. And they would come home and what would they do? What they know best, continue to commit offenses because they became unemployable. They perhaps didn't have education to rely on. The reality is we lost a population of young kids. And to what?
Judge Cubbin is a trailblazer. She took her budget. She didn't ask the state of Ohio for any extra money, any extra favors. She took the budget that was already there, and she created a series of programs. When you come into her court, she would give you a chance to stay in your home life, go to school, but still adhere to these programs that she would set up for you that she created through her courts and monitoring. And as a result of these programs, her numbers dropped by more than half of the amount of people she's sending to kids' services, a.k.a. kitty jail.
So, Dominic, you saw this judge. Do you wish you had gone through a program like that?
I do. You know, Michael and I have had a lot of conversations specifically with regard to programming, and I believe that good programming is good security. In the prison, and as we start to transcend from prison back into the community, how we take a look at how we are affecting people when they are in secure and controlled environments is extremely important with regard to the outcome of those specific individuals once they get back into the community. If we don't start to take a look at people's values, if we don't start to have a conversation about integrity and some of the other things that it will take to be successful once you're released, then I assure you that most people will go back.
So through your own personal experience and through this documentary, what are viewers supposed to take away from it? What's the major lesson?
Redemption. That's the first lesson for me. For the community, second chances. You know, we are a country that believes in second chances, I think. And what are we doing to address gun violence? What are we doing to reduce the level of violence that are happening in poor communities? We are losing generations and generations of young people because people are standing by saying, you know, I'm just not going to be involved. You know, this has nothing to do with me. And what I submit to you is that we are all affected by this. Every single person in the community is affected by it. And I think that we need to take a serious look at how we can be actively involved in being part of the solution.
And the most important thing we should keep in mind is remember that these are still children. America has the largest amount of juvenile arrest in the world.
Thank you very much, Michael Kenneth Williams, actor and host of the first episode of this season's Vice on HBO, and Dominic DuPont, a man who served 20 years in prison, starting at the age of 19, but is now fighting for the cause. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
It's The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. The border is now a defining issue in American politics. On Tuesday, in lieu of getting his wall, President Donald Trump promised soldiers would soon be guarding the U.S.-Mexican border.
We have very bad laws for our border, and we are going to be doing some things. I've been speaking with General Mattis. We're going to be doing things militarily. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. That's a big step. We really haven't done that before, or certainly not very much before.
Now, it's not clear where that plan is headed, but there is a border policy in place. The reason you may not have heard about it, it's largely invisible. It's called Prevention Through Deterrence. It started in the mid-1990s. Its development and consequences are the focus of a new three-part series from our partner at WNYC Radiolab called The Border Trilogy. Jason DeLeon is an anthropology professor at the University of Michigan. He studies the border and worked with Radiolab to examine the policy. And Latif Nasser is a reporter for Radiolab. Here's Latif.
Prevention through deterrence is basically just another name for the National Border Patrol strategy enacted in 1994. And basically the idea of the strategy was to block off, you know, the most heavily trafficked areas of illegal immigration, which were, you know, in cities like El Paso or San Diego or south of Tucson, but then leave open as the only routes to cross these pretty remote and naturally hostile areas like the desert. That then led to people crossing in these more remote areas and then people dying. And what we found in our part of our reporting, and this is also in the work of the sociologist Timothy Dunn, is that one of the roots of this policy is this lawsuit. There was this school in El Paso. It's literally right across the border. It's called Bowie High School. And what happened was that the Border Patrol, they had, as part of their strategy in the early 90s of apprehending people who would cross, they would basically spend a lot of time at this school because there was a hole in the fence across from this school. So a lot of migrants would be crossing illegally. The Border Patrol would be stationed at this school. In doing that, they would also be harassing a lot of students and staff at this school. And at some point, the students and staff said, we're tired of this, and they sue the Border Patrol. Very unlikely they win. They win against the Border Patrol. But in response to that, because it was a big national news story, that was one of the factors that then made the Border Patrol sort of sit back and think, you know what? We need to rethink our whole strategy. And as part of that, they came out with this totally different strategy. Instead of waiting for people to cross and then apprehending them, the new strategy would be to sort of position the Border Patrol agents on the border, right on the border, to prevent people from coming in the first place. And so that was sort of in some ways the genesis of this policy, unlikely as it is to come from, you know, a bunch of high school kids standing up for their rights.
There's also a death count in the desert as a result of this.
So one of the folks we talked to as part of this reporting was a former Border Patrol sector chief of the Tucson sector, so basically Arizona. You know, his tenure there was in the 90s, and he talked about in the early 90s the number of people that would die and that they would find in the desert, you know, it was single digits. And then sort of as it went on into the late 90s and early 2000s, as this strategy, as the flow of migrant traffic started to change, you know, the numbers started creeping up. They went higher and higher and higher. You know, they passed 100, like 150 a year kind of thing. Those deaths really started to tick up as people who were wanting to cross couldn't go through the urban areas. They had to find another way.
And that's supposed to be the deterrence. I mean, it's just so problematic, the thought that this policy would push people to an area that's more dangerous, and obviously that's a deterrence, and that area is littered with bodies. And people know this. And so knowing that, in theory, should have prevented people from taking that route. But it actually didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and we even talked to some of the people who made this policy, like the former INS Commissioner Doris Meissner, and I think they really underestimated the drive of some of these people who are looking to provide for their family or to reunite with their family.
What has been one of the most important consequences over time has been the tenacity of people coming to the United States, wanting to come to the United States, and the lengths to which people will go in order to do that.
They really underestimated the drive that these people really would go through the desert. And that, you know, miscalculation has had really fatal consequences.
When we talk about that miscalculation, I want to turn to Jason, because you've been studying the real life effects of this policy. You did experiments on pigs. How was that related to this?
Well, one of the things that I had become increasingly interested over the years was, you know, what happens to people who die during this process? And there had been a lot of speculation when I started this work about what the desert would potentially do to a body. And people would say, well, maybe it gets mummified, maybe animals eat it, maybe there's a lot of bodies out there that we're not finding because nature is destroying them. And what I found was that nobody had been doing any kind of systematic research on this issue. The Pima County Officer of the Medical Examiner, I mean, they were recovering hundreds of bodies a year, but everyone kind of knew that that wasn't the full picture. And so I basically took a crash course in forensic science. I had been trained in archaeology, and I learned really quickly that pigs had been used for the last couple of decades as a proxy for the human body in different types of forensic experiments. What really set me off with this was being out in the desert in 2011 and coming across a fragment of a person, you know, a human arm, a tooth, some bones that had been eaten and regurgitated by animals. So I kind of went into it knowing, okay, if we do this experiment, if we take pigs, we dress them up like migrants and put them into different environmental contexts and monitor that, I think that nature's going to do some damage to these bodies. We didn't really have a sense of what it would look like, though. And what it ended up being was, in some instances, in less than 36 hours, you have dozens of vultures skeletonizing and completely ripping apart 150, 160-pound skeleton body in a really short amount of time. And then water impacting the bodies, ants breaking up bone and carrying pieces away. So it became obvious pretty quickly during these experiments that nature is erasing many people out there in this environmental context.
It used to be that the easiest way to find a number for the dead is to count the bodies. And I know you found pieces, but you're telling me that there are a lot of bodies that just don't exist anymore. So is there any sort of estimate of the real number of people that die crossing the desert?
It just depends on who you ask, because it's thousands. I mean, in Arizona, the body count is, you know, it depends on how you calculate it, but between 3,000 and 5,000 bodies. People go back and forth about those sorts of counts. But if you look at the missing persons reports in Mexico and coming from Central America, those numbers are far greater. And the problem, though, is that by design, prevention through deterrence brutalizes these people. It uses the desert to do it, so nobody can really be blamed for this. So the Border Patrol will say, well, if you die in the desert, that's your fault for going into the desert. Nobody wants to say, well, we made this policy where that would be the path of least resistance. So this thing happens. Nature is conscripted to do this border enforcement work, but it also happens in a place where nobody can see it. So it's completely invisible, these dead bodies. And then with enough time, nature will then erase these individuals. And so it becomes impossible to get a firm count on this.
So Latif, you actually found a report from 1997 saying that if there were more deaths in the desert, that would be a sign that the policy was actually working. What does that say about the current practice? I know you spoke with the person who developed the policy in El Paso. Here's what he had to say.
This was my effort at stopping a chaotic, out-of-control situation that everybody hated. It's easy to criticize, but it's a hell of a lot harder to say, okay, if not this, then what?
Explain this justification a little bit more.
So, and first let me just quick say that report, I can't take credit for finding that. That was actually something that Jason found. But the point that Sylvester Reyes is bringing up there, the problems that Sylvester Reyes was tackling in El Paso, they were real problems. I mean, it was a chaotic scenario, and he brought that situation under control, right? Controlling the border. But I think what's so damning about that report from 1997, saying that the people who framed this policy, or at least you know, the GAO that was looking at that strategy document, were saying, look, like, we have an inkling that this is going to happen. This is a foreseeable thing. The policy that was in place before prevention through deterrence of letting people sort of cross the border in these urban areas, there's a very high political cost to that. That there is not in letting migrants cross in the desert where, you know, where people who are voting don't see it and, you know, make hay about it. There is a lot of politics in this, I think, that prevention through deterrence is a lot easier a policy to put forward, even though it has these fatal costs.
So, Jason, what's the current state of the Border Patrol under Trump?
So there's a lot of different opinions within the Border Patrol, I think, about this policy, and also not a lot of common knowledge about the evolution of it. And, you know, you're asking about the current state of things. We don't even talk about prevention through deterrence anymore as a program. It's just taken for granted that this is the working security paradigm that we've had for a long time, to the point where it doesn't show up in documents anymore. Everyone just knows that this is what they're doing. The sleight of hand that has happened, a kind of hocus pocus, is they have shifted the discourse away from saying the desert can be this physical barrier to not talking about the desert at all, but now to say migrants are dying in the desert because smugglers bring them through the desert, and the Border Patrol is committed to rescuing those migrants. And so they have changed their approach now to say, look, we've got things like the Borstar, which is their search and rescue that's out there looking for migrants. They've got their missing migrants program that's in place trying to say, look, we are working to help identify these bodies. But nobody at the agency wants to say, well, this whole problem that we are putting Band-Aids on through fancy brochures and, you know, these press conferences, this whole problem is systemic. It's been going on for 2 decades, and we don't want to cop to it anymore.
Lastly, is there any talk of change, or is this just something that we are willing to accept with our current immigration policy?
When we talked to Doris Meissner as part of our reporting, she was the commissioner of the INS at that time. So she was, in a way, she was the head. She was in charge of the Border Patrol, and she was the one who really wrote that 1994 document, that Prevention Through Deterrence, that outlined that whole strategy. She still is sort of active in this world in thinking about this issue. And she basically said that even though she does feel sorry about these deaths and that something needs to be done about it, but she basically said that in her 40 years of working on this issue, in a way, this is maybe the most hopeless time, that we're so far from having a kind of open, frank conversation about these issues and how to sort of approach the border in a non-hypocritical way. We're not even having the conversation to even then go on to fix it. We're so far from in any way changing or fixing this problem.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Latif Nasser, reporter for Radiolab, and Jason DeLeon, anthropology professor at the University of Michigan. He studies the border.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
And this is my last day on The Takeaway for now. It's been great being with you for nearly 2 weeks. You can stay with me on Twitter. I'm at Duarte Geraldino. Todd Zwillick is back tomorrow. And remember, The Takeaway's new host, Tenzina Vega, starts in May. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and this is The Takeaway. When water levels creep higher, so does salt.
It used to be solid wetland, and now the water level is constantly higher, so I call it rotten.
Farmers along the eastern seaboard say climate change is destroying the land they've been farming for hundreds of years. That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.